For another perspective on adjuvant therapy, I invited adjuvant wizard Dr. Peter Ravden to join a roundtable, including Dr. Langer and Dr. Vince Miller. The recording took place at the annual education retreat of the Florida Cancer Specialist Oncology Group. Dr. Ravden is experimenting with an adjuvant model for lung cancer, and my hope was that he and I could bring in lessons from breast cancer in the discussion, which began with Peter commenting on the critical issue of competing causes of mortality in older patients and why this is a particularly important issue in lung cancer.
The default estimates of competing mortality by age are higher in lung cancer because you can clearly see that in the SEER data, that patients actually do slightly worse than they would against an age-matched group for competing mortality, which isn't surprising. You can see elevated deaths due to cardiovascular disease and COPD-like illnesses. How to actually adjust for the other parameters is something that would require essentially an adjuvant-like program in cardiovascular disease and pulmonary disease. And there may be some summary numbers. That would be a place where it could be improved. But right now, you're left with relatively crude ways of adjusting for that.
One of the things that came out, Vince, in breast cancer is this concept of relative risk reduction. And that's the basis for this whole thing, which is you come up with a relative risk reduction and then you look at the absolute risk and just factor it in. That's kind of what the model does. Do we have enough data in lung cancer to begin to do that?
I think we have a body of data in which we can start to do it. But as Peter said, the quality of the data is not great. So I think we need to enhance that. We have a new set of variables we need to look at in clinical trials. The staging information that's available is not optimal. Is it one node at one station? Was it microscopic nodal disease? Was it multi-nodal disease that was bulky, et cetera? Those are some of the, in the future, it may be, what's their EGFR mutation status or FISH or CISH status? So, you know, we always lag behind breast cancer by a few years, and this may be no exception.
Corey, we know that more than half the oncologists in the United States are using adjuvant for breast. I think the use in colon is about, what, one-tenth of what it is in breast, Peter?
I'd say it's one-quarter, yeah.
One-quarter, okay. Do you think that this is going to have a future in lung cancer in the next couple of years?
Adjuvant online or just adjuvant?
Adjuvant
therapy?
Online.
I think it will, but I think we need more trials. I agree with Vince. It's not so much that the quality of the data is not so good. It's the quantity of data that's still lacking. We really, in the modern era, only have 5 or 6 trials. So the analogy would be perhaps the late 80s for breast cancer. And to be honest, I worry that this may be a little bit premature for a number of the reasons that Vince has raised. There are so many nuances that go into our therapeutic decision making, particularly in lung cancer, that have a lot more to do with just the tumor itself, all the comorbidities that that particular patient has, their performance status. This, by and large, is a population that's generally older, a bit more ill than a breast cancer population. So the data we see on a cooperative group trial or a European trial does not necessarily extrapolate to the patient we have.
Maybe we're seriously underestimating the non-cancer causes of death in these patients. I wonder whether or not these people are at much greater risk for non-cancer mortality than we realize.
Well, I think on average, they actually don't have a dramatically different. They act like they're 3 to 5 years older than they otherwise would be. That's the average patient. Now, I will say one thing about this tool. It's designed to be used in the adjuvant scenario. The majority of patients never make it to completely resected disease. So that you have to remember that these are patients who have been in good enough shape to undergo at least a lobectomy. And so that these are not your average lung cancer patients. This is a selected set of patients that has gotten to this point. And I think that in that patient population, my major question is that if you take a look at it in stage one disease, you have like on average at least a 25% 5-year mortality, which is a ferocious mortality. But then you have therapies, and there's great debate as to whether or not it applies to those patients with 20% efficacy. And that actually is a 5% benefit. And lung cancer patients, on general, aren't as demanding as breast cancer patients. But there's an area where that's a substantial benefit. And in breast cancer, we would always treat without any question. In lung cancer, it's less obvious to the patient.
Vince, I think you meant to say lung cancer patients other than those in New York are less demanding. Sorry, Doug.
Or Naples.
Or Naples, yeah. Because I saw that expression on your face when he said that. Dr. Raymond?
Going back to the issue of comorbidities, in the breast cancer operator, we saw the example of how changing the risk from standard to an increased comorbidity changes the equation dramatically in that case. And my concern is that when I use my best estimate when I use the breast cancer or the colon cancer, I use the colon cancer quite a bit myself, we're talking about the quantitation of the tumor and the size and the grade, and then we're using thumbnail estimates. What are the comorbidities? If anything I need, it's a little more quantitation, like we were talking about FEV1 in the lung cancer, but also how many drugs you're taking for hypertension, some more quantitative data that would allow me to be a little more confident on what I put in on the comorbidity side. You know, how big is that blue bar going to be?
Corey, are there any things that you look at in terms of comorbidities? Do you look at FEV1 or any specific things that really bring up a red light?
Well, again, by definition, if they made it to the adjuvant setting, right, they had an adequate FEV1 pre-op, but part of their lung's been removed, so their post-op FEV1 may be a bit marginal. They may or may not require oxygen at certain times. Unfortunately, the studies that have looked at adjuvant therapy have done a lousy job so far of correlating outcome with comorbidity. So we're really in an unknown territory. We can extrapolate perhaps from advanced disease, but I think that's dangerous. There are a number of instruments we can use. The Charlson Comorbidity Index is easy, takes 5 minutes. It's basically a quantification of the number of ailments. There are scales looking at polypharmacy, but retrospectively applying that to the data is impossible at this point.
Vince, what's your take on the CALGB study, and what are your thoughts about carbotaxol in a non-protocol setting as adjuvant therapy?
I tend to still interpret that generally, you know, with the caveats of the p-value and so forth, as a positive trial. I think all the trends are in the right direction. I mean, it's an extremely small trial. It may well be that the next iteration has a p-value of 0.04, and then it's back in the good graces of the Dick Grawlers of the world and those who are really statistical purists. I think the issues with the platinums, it's interesting they've come back to center stage. I do believe that, as Corey's conclusion slide said, that cisplatin is the preferred component of a doublet in the adjuvant setting. Remember, the doses in some of these regimens, like in BR10, are 50 per meter squared day 1 and 8, so a little bit more tolerable than the big swig every 4 weeks. Nonetheless, there clearly are a subset of patients in whom you can't do that, and that's where you're really challenged. Do you do nothing, or do you give carbotaxol in a resected stage 2 as a creatinine of 1.8? And I think that's the challenge that probably we all see in our practices, and maybe people in practice see more than those in academic settings.
Any questions or comments from the group? I'm sure you've heard about the CALGB study. How are you approaching adjuvant therapy nowadays?
You still have cisplatin in your pharmacies, or
are you using cisplatin? Lowell?
I would in a fit patient. I mean, it's extremely complicated, I think, in practice because some of the patients don't have the greatest surgical staging. Minority of patients that we really see that are adjuvant candidates to start with. You know, if I saw a patient that was fit, I would probably give them cisplatin taxotere. And one that was not that fit, I agree. I think the carbotaxol is quite. So I've usually used carbotaxol in our setting of the patients that I see. I'd say that's pretty much what I've given.
Scott?
What about the role of the expertise of the surgeon in this disease? You know, we've talked a lot about the chemotherapy, but in other diseases, ovarian cancer, complicated hepatobiliary cancers, the expertise of the operator clearly impacts almost as an independent factor on the prognosis. Is that the same for complicated thoracic surgery? And are we overlooking the one entity that potentially could really mitigate the prognosis of the patient?
Corey?
I think you've touched upon an extremely crucial issue. I use the mediastinal nodes as my gauge for the expertise of the surgeon. If they have not been looked at, that surgeon has no business operating on lung cancer. It would be analogous to not evaluating axillary nodes in breast cancer. And frequently, probably more often than not, we get people who we've been told have early stage lung cancer, they had a lobectomy, they looked at parabronchial nodes, they might have picked off a hilar node, but the mediastinal wasn't even looked at, wasn't even explored. There's a completed ACOSOG trial that actually addressed the mediastinal node question. It's looking at sampling versus dissection, but doesn't really address the larger issue of incompetent surgeons. Once they've gone through the operation and they truly had a proper lung cancer operation, Then it's really, I believe it's the patient, it's the comorbidities and the stage that finally govern outcome more so than the surgical expertise. Although if they've had a lot of perioperative complications, that may influence whether you're ever going to give them adjuvant treatment. And here it may not be so much the surgeon, but the entire care team, the pulmonologist that sees the patient in the perioperative or postoperative setting.
Bill?
I have a case that I saw yesterday that I'd like to present with that in mind. Actually, my nurse practitioner, Diane Cope, mainly did this. But it's a 59-year-old woman, ordered a CAT scan on herself because she was a cigarette smoker, had a left upper lobe mass. Actually, two lung cancer patients this week I had who made their own diagnosis. One was a CAT scan technologist, but that was a small cell. So this patient had a 3-centimeter tumor. The PET scan showed the tumor in one left hilar lymph node, underwent a left upper lobectomy. One peribronchial lymph node was removed, was positive. No other lymph nodes removed at all. Perfect candidate for adjuvant treatment. What do I do next? What's the role of radiation, if any? And should I pursue any other procedure other than treating the patient with adjuvant chemotherapy?
Did they remove that perihilar node?
Yes. That was actually a peribronchial lymph node.
And that was the one that lit up on PET?
Yes.
Presumably. And the mediastinum was negative on PET?
Negative on PET, but not sampled. No other nodes
and
removed.
And CT was negative, presumably, in the mediastinum.
Correct.
So it's a clinical stage 2.
Who did the surgery? I'm kind of curious who does this surgery.
Well, in Fort Myers, we have cardiovascular surgeons. We don't really have a dedicated thoracic oncologic surgeon. We do send a fair number of patients to Larry Robinson at Moffitt, who does a great job, but not everybody.
So you don't have enough volume to have a thoracic surgeon as a cardiothoracic surgeon. I assume that that's pretty typical, what's going on in this country. Is that the case, Vince?
I think so. I think that you really, I know that Harvey Pass struggles with this. There's been a decade of cardiac surgeons who may be great with valves and bypassing and things, doing lung cancer surgery and sending me patients with an unstaged mediastinum, and he's wrestling with that as he tries to improve things at NYU.
Do you want to comment on Bill's case?
Sure. I think you can feel a little bit better since you had the negative PET and CT for the mediastinum. I would be offering this patient the 16-week cisplatin vinorelbine regimen, assuming they were in good shape. It's actually, when you alternate the vinorelbine dose and have low every other week, the 12.5, it's actually fairly tolerable. And this is a relatively young patient, unfortunately well below the median age of lung cancer patients we see.
Can you just spell out exactly what your schedule is?
It's day 1-8, 29, 36, and you know, every 4 weeks afterwards with 50 per meter squared of platinum. So they basically get 8 platinum treatments at 50. And then 25 alternating with 12.5 of vinorelbine for 16 weeks.
Corey? This node was positive, is that right? So the peribronchial node was lit up and it was positive?
Yes.
And it was 1-for-1 or 1-for-6?
Just 1-for-1.
1-for-1. I agree with Vince, I'd use vinorelbine cisplatin. I actually use a different regimen. Francis Shepard, who's really the guru of this combo, which most of us have limited expertise with, is now giving 75 to 80 per meter squared day one every 3 to 4 weeks, trying to get it in at 3-week intervals. And the vinorelbine is 25 per meter squared, day 1 and 8, every 3 weeks. And we have started using that. I'm rather schizophrenic, actually, when it comes to how I approach these patients. So if they do have nodal involvement, if they're N1 or N2, they've been completely resected, they had an R0 resection. We don't really know that here. I will use the vinorelbine cisplatin combination. I have to say that's a change in my practice since ASCO. For 1B, bigger than 4 centimeters, I will still give paclitaxel and carboplatin.
I think Corey would agree with me there's no role for radiation here.
I would agree, although I worry that we've missed microscopic nodal involvement. We have a peribronchial node that was involved or a hilar node. There's been no sampling. This is the sort of patient I would not be surprised if they pop up with a mediastinal recurrence in a year or two.
Well,
in the advanced disease setting, I believe cis-taxotere beats cis-navalbine. Does that have any bearing in any of your decisions about the adjuvant setting?
Yeah, if you look at that paper, it's a subtlety. Your overall impression is the impression of the oncologic community. If you look at that paper, actually, though, the p-value is listed, I think, as 0.044, but it's not significant because of one or more interim analyses that were done when you look at that Kaplan-Meier survival curve. Nonetheless, do I think that makes it reasonable to extrapolate and use cisplatin, docetaxel in the adjuvant setting? Yes, I think it's a reasonable thing to do. But on the other hand, I don't know that it's any easier when you give it Q3 weeks as opposed to the smaller divided doses of cisplatin, vinorelbine. And I think Frances has revised her schedule over the years, because the one I was using was her schedule from a year or two ago, which we actually sort of like, because you never really get the major league platinum toxicity. I tell patients beforehand, you are likely to miss several of these treatments, and you shouldn't be discouraged or dissuaded by that. The survival benefit is in patients like yourself. No one gets through this unscathed.
What is it that prevents you from getting the treatment in usually?
Depends on the regimen, but even in our most recent adjuvant experience, which was a small trial we did with cisplatin docetaxel, more than half the patients dropped out after one cycle. That's why we're nervous about the ECOG 1505 in a big setting, if the Memorial post-surgical patients couldn't cruise through. So,
but again, why?
With the cisplatin vinorelbine, it's usually they miss because of blood counts.
But they finish the four cycles.
They usually get through the 16 weeks.
I have no personal experience with docetaxel and cisplatin in the adjuvant setting. A lot of my colleagues are using it for the reason that you've offered, that advanced disease, it had a non-inferiority. Remember, that's what's in the package insert versus vinorelbine cisplatin, which I think most of us would interpret as at least as good, if not better. Having said that, there are no phase 3 data with that combination. All the data with vinorelbine cisplat or Taxol Carbo. So it's all by extrapolation. I don't think it's going to be worse. I doubt it's going to be significantly better. And the upcoming ECOG trial is going to feature chemo du jour. You'll have a menu of options to pick. I don't think we're as caught up in lung cancer as the breast cancer world is in comparing minute changes in regimens. The presumption is various platinum cocktails are probably going to do the same. We really have to ask other questions, and particularly the introduction of targeted agents.
And actually, that's a good lead into Vince, who's going to talk about the adjuvant trial. And actually, I guess the chemo du jour is changing, or what defines the chemo du jour is being looked at a little bit more closely. Vince? Let me just ask before you talk. Bill, what do you think you're going to do with your patient?
I'm going to treat it with cisplatin-based chemotherapy. I was sort of hard to choose between Taxotere and Avalbine, but I'll discuss with her.
What have you generally been doing when you've been using cis?
I've used it more probably with Taxotere. The other thing is usually you have to put a port with Avalbine, so it's another little factor, not a big thing.
Corey, can you update us on what we know about the toxicity of bevacizumab and lung cancer? We had the initial data that was presented last year, and there was some updates, and what your thoughts are about how bevacizumab is going to play out in the adjuvant setting in lung cancer from a safety point of view.
If you remember, ECOG 4599, the trial that Vince alluded to, showed a 2-month improvement in median survival, about a 6-8% improvement in 1- and 2-year survival. It also showed more toxicity, particularly hemorrhage. There were 15 treatment-related deaths, not all from hemorrhage, some from neutropenic fever, other causes, in the bevacizumab arm compared to maybe 2 treatment-related deaths in the control group. So even though we eliminated squamous histology, which in the randomized phase 2 was the group where we had seen a much higher percentage of hemorrhage, we also eliminated patients with brain metastasis, ongoing thromboembolic phenomena or anticoagulation, antecedent hemoptysis, and ECOG 4599, we still saw a heightened treatment-related death rate. I think a lot of those concerns are going to fall by the wayside in the adjuvant trial. The tumors are gone. They've been resected. By definition, these patients have no residual tumor in the chest. They ideally should not have pulmonary hemorrhage. There are some concerns about healing, and in fact, I think at least with the study design, it's a 6-12 week wait from surgery. Look at older trials, it's often 4-8 weeks. The same concern about brain mets does not operate here. This is resected early stage disease. The patients presumably won't have brain metastasis. On the other hand, if they've had significant thromboembolic phenomenon in the past, need anticoagulation, I don't believe they can go on this trial. But you look at the overall population, it's probably only about 10-15%. So I'm a bit less worried in this group looking at bevacizumab than I would be in the advanced disease population. But I am worried when we start looking at some of these other regimens. There is an ongoing European trial looking at GemCis with or without bevacizumab, finished accrual, allegedly no major toxicities, but we really have to see the data. I'm not aware of any pre-existing phase 2 work looking at bevacizumab with either docetaxel, vinorelbine, and cisplatin. I imagine there are probably some ongoing studies, but certainly no published or presented data. So we've ditched the one arm that was been tested in ECOG 4599, paclitaxel and carboplatin, the one arm where we have the most safety data, which has shown a benefit, remember, in 4 cm or larger 1B, and we're strictly using cisplatin regimen. So you can see I'm a little bit exercised about this. I think we've inadvertently eliminated about 50% of the patients we might have otherwise accrued to this study.
Peter?
I would just say that I would agree with your last statement, and that from somebody who thinks about breast cancer looking in on lung, you know, it strikes me as the two recommended chemotherapy regimens, two of the three, there's no adjuvant data for. And one of them, which is a very popular and widely used regimen, which has got a trend to suggest that superiority for survival, at least we have some data for it, it has been eliminated. And that strikes me as, you know, in breast cancer, we wouldn't be, I think, using so many regimens for which we had no adjuvant data whatsoever.
Well, just to reassure you that our tax dollars are going to good use, the cisplatin vinorelbine, the best validated of these regimens, will use doses and schedules that have never been studied before.
There's now a lot more excitement about adjuvant trials in lung cancer than there was a few years ago. We have something to put our hand on. And you talk to the clinical investigators in lung cancer, and they say, well, this is going to be different this time. We are going to be able to get patients on studies. Now, in the last few months, I'm hearing all kinds of problems coming out. We had a think tank this summer, and there was a lot of concerns about whether or not an adjuvant bevacizumab trial was actually going to get done.
I think we're identifying what I call a town gown issue. This trial has been formulated by academic centers, many of which have, shall I say, stalwart cisplatin advocates who have never felt that carboplatin measures up to cisplatin. Certainly in advanced disease, if you do meta-analysis, you can see perhaps a 3 or 4 week difference in overall median survival, which, frankly, in advanced disease is irrelevant. It may be more relevant in adjuvant. That's the argument that's been raised. But I don't think I'm quite as pessimistic as you are. I think it's going to get done. I think it's going to obviously take longer. We may encounter some hitherto unappreciated toxicities that we might not have anticipated simply because there were no phase two testings of these combinations with bevacizumab, but it's going to be a challenge.
Norm told me that yesterday the CO8 study that so many of you here in this room have put patients on, the adjuvant Bev colon trial, closed. 2,700 patients in 2 years. It's done.
We'll never do a study that quickly in lung cancer. If we could do it in 6 years, it would be nice. Got to remember, only about 30% of our patients present with early stage disease, very different from breast cancer.
But you have one hell of a lot of events.
Yes, we'll have events. Unfortunately, we're going to have them sooner.
Any thoughts, Lowell?
I personally think adjuvant erlotinib is a real major question in this disease because of my resected patients that I've been just thinking while we were talking here recently. I think that population is kind of enriched for the females, non-smokers, adenocarcinomas, or oligosmokers, because those tend to be the ones that are healthy and that surgeons are enthusiastic about resecting, whereas like a 65-year-old squamous cell heavy smoker, you know, they're not going to present with early stage disease usually. So I've seen a few of those, and I've gotten some mutation analysis in some of those, and happily for me, they've been negative. But if they would have been positive, I would have had a real tough decision about after chemo whether I would put them on erlotinib or not. I mean, if it was me, I would take a year of erlotinib, absolutely, or maybe two. If it was my family member, I certainly would, and I think that needs to be really answered.
I want to ask Vince about that issue of off-protocol erlotinib in the non-smoker or the mutation-positive patient. What do you think?
Could I present a case, Neil? I have a
perfect
case for that. Okay. She's 55. I treated her about 7, 8 years ago, adjuvant chemotherapy for colon cancer. She presents with a bronchoalveolar carcinoma, undergoes a right lower lobectomy. It's 2.5 centimeters. It was resected by Larry Robinson, all lymph nodes negative. She's mutation positive. I forget if it's exon 19 or 21. And I actually emailed the case around to several people. And
non-smoker?
Oligo, as Dr. Hart calls it, oligo smoker.
Just out of curiosity, do you know when did she quit and how many packs did she have?
She really maybe smoked up to age 30, 35. So it'd been like 20 years ago.
And how many years did she smoke?
Maybe 15-pack years.
15-pack years.
So she was resected, and of course I raised the question, you know, what about erlotinib? And there are actually some people that actually would even recommend adjuvant chemo here. Most would say not do anything, and maybe one person said erlotinib. I ended up not doing anything because I think that's the standard, and unless she and her husband really wanted to deviate, I wasn't really going to recommend anything. I thought her prognosis was still fairly good.
What would you say her risk of recurrence is, anyway?
Well, this is the type of thing that needs to be refined when we look at adjuvant models, but Bob Ginsberg used to say there's no better tumor for prognosis than a stage 1 BAC. This lady probably isn't the 70% five-year survival. She's probably 80 or 85%, even though her tumor was 2.5 centimeters. And the mutations, of course, may be a surrogate for a better natural history anyway. I've seen patients with most of the brain mets in lung cancer develop in the first year. I've seen patients with brain mets 3 or 4 years later as their first recurrence. So it's a whole different biology, I believe. And that's my lead-in to say I probably would have left her alone, as you did, and had some security in knowing that if she gets a recurrence that can't be taken out, they have a pretty effective therapy.
You're saying she has a 15% chance of recurrence, and I bring it back to the analogy of breast cancer. I mean, I'm not saying that erlotinib is the same as hormonal therapy, but in terms of serious side effects, I'm not sure it's that much different. The rash is a problem. But we certainly would be using hormonal therapy in a patient with a 15% chance of recurrence. Obviously, we have the data there. But Vince, what are you thinking in terms of why you wouldn't want to use it? Because of lack of supporting data?
I think the mindset probably of a lung cancer doctor is so different from a breast cancer doctor. I hear think of somebody having an 80 or 85, aside from the fact we don't have the data. Because biologically, if she had a stage 2 cancer, I would have been jumping to take the pill. But I think when we can tell somebody they have an 80 or 85% cure, that's like the best patient we ever see in our practice. And so I think that's where it comes from. It is tougher to get through than hormones. It's not trivial. And a lot of the patients, it's probably whatever predisposes you to the mutation is some germline thing that also predisposes you to toxicity. So I think it is tougher. A lot of patients, we do have an adjuvant with mutations, and I do it. Depends on the, you know, what I think the likelihood of recurrence is, or down at 25 or 50 milligrams a day.
That raises another question. In looking at the adjuvant trials when I was thinking about her case, it was really hard to find trials that had anything but a handful of bronchoalveolar patients. I don't even know what exactly is the role, if any, of adjuvant chemotherapy in the bronchoalveolar population.
The problem is that we're just paying attention to histology and lung cancer again now after 15 years of time off from it. So when all the cooperative groups analyzed their databases in the late 80s, early 90s, there was never any difference for response or survival if you had squamous, large cell adeno. So one thing that came out of a meeting we did in New York was that the cooperative groups, I don't know if it's actually happened, were going to make an attempt to better annotate our pathology, particularly in trials of targeted therapies that may have a differential mechanism of action depending on what tumor type you have. So at the present time, you treat your bronchoalveolar like you would an adenocarcinoma of a given stage and do the best, you know, go by that.
Peter, I think you were at the think tank when I tried to bring up the analogy between TKIs and the enriched population looking at mutations and non-smoking as a way to predict response to therapy compared to HER2 and Herceptin. And my tenet was actually the response rate in the enriched population for lung cancer is greater than with Herceptin. Do you agree with that?
What was the response rate in the enriched population again?
What number would you quote, Vince?
Oh, it's the pooled response rate's probably conservatively 70%.
For those who are
mutation
positive,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And what about in non-smokers?
In never smokers, the response rate is about 50%.
Okay, so you look at Herceptin as a single agent, it's not that high.
No, it compares with the estrogen receptor, actually, or even more powerfully.
This is not a benign drug. Remember, this is not tamoxifen. These patients get rash at a minimum. Many get diarrhea. They may have other problems. If you look at the BR21 trial, 5% had to discontinue therapy because of toxicity. I think in our clinical practices, it's probably a higher percentage, particularly in an East Asian population. Interstitial lung disease is not trivial. It doesn't seem to be operative, at least in North America. And if we look at an unselected population, and again, this is probably a flaw of the study, but in locally advanced disease, if you look at the SWOG study, which looked at etoposide platinum radiation followed by docetaxel and then randomization and maintenance gefitinib or observation, p-value was actually in the wrong direction. The gefitinib arm had an inferior survival. It wasn't significant, but it was heading there, 0.09. So outside of a study setting, I don't do it. Even in those who are, I think that's one area where Vince and I differ. I will not give it to a higher risk patient either. I have tremendous respect for the potential toxicities that this drug has, and we have zero randomized prospective phase 3 testing.
What serious toxicities are there besides the rash?
Diarrhea, which can sometimes really alter whether a patient's going to continue with the drug. The rash can get quite severe too, although I think most of us who have experience dealing with the rash have a number of strategies to mitigate it.
I think the hard part's to get them through the first month, but after that, most of the toxicities seem to attenuate.
For the second part of the roundtable meeting, the discussion shifted to management of metastatic disease, and particularly the emerging role of bevacizumab. To begin, I asked Dr. Langer about the issue of hemoptysis.
Corey, do you think that the cavitation and bleeding, you say it's a class effect, do you think it has something to do with the mechanism of action or just a response?
Definitely the response. Many of the patients that we've seen, some of the more worrisome bleeding episodes, have actually demonstrated tumor response. So it could be that these patients are in fact responding too quickly. Whether it has something else to do with the mechanism of action is really unclear to me. I don't know if Vince has some additional insights. It's conceivable that these folks may have more vascular tumors and therefore we see more necrosis, but that's purely speculative.
Vince, what do you think is going on with these patients?
Well, I think the thing that raises questions or maybe answers some questions is that in small cell, although the data hasn't been presented, it's pretty widely known from the ECOG folks, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the trial, the phase 2 trial that had an interim analysis where it was stopped, like 50 or 60 patients, I think, and now is finishing up with possible phase 3 trial plan, there is essentially no grade 4 or 5 pulmonary events. And so that's a centrally located tumor. It's often endobronchial. It changes rapidly in response to chemo. So I think it's something largely peculiar to squamous cell, although now we're getting away from that and allowing, making it more peripheral tumors are allowed and central tumors may be the risk. I think it may be the biology of the particular histologic subtype.
Cavitation as well in non-squamous, although clearly squamous appears to be much more at risk.
By the way, the deaths on sunitinib, at least the two pulmonary deaths were in squamous cell patients. The patient who died of the intracranial hemorrhage had a brain met in that spot, may have also been a squamous cell patient. So I asked Mark, and he didn't know whether they're going to change their eligibility on subsequent trials to exclude squamous patients as well.
We did a retrospective analysis of our patient population. At the time, 4599 was ongoing, and fully 60% of patients might otherwise have gone on to clinical trials. Typical clinical trial of chemo du jour versus some other chemo combo or some other unselected nonspecific target agent, 60% could not have gone on to 4599. So as Vince has pointed out, it's a moving target, but still, even when it does get its approval, those 60% will remain excluded. Brain met, squam, anticoagulation. Having said that, I would say probably fewer than half of those who are potentially eligible are actually getting it. This specter of pulmonary toxicity, of pulmonary hemorrhage, fatal hemorrhage, is a showstopper. And never mind the fact that these patients have 100% chance of dying of their metastatic cancer. When they hear that, it gives them pause. Many of them will opt not to get it up front. Some of them will allow me to graft it on later. Whether it does any good at that point is unclear. I'd say overall I have fewer than 10, probably 8 or 9 patients who have been on it in the last year. But I am using it. I haven't seen any of the awful toxicity, at least since the conclusion of the trial. I did have one of those fatal pulmonary hemorrhages on 4599.
Well,
we've been using it mostly on trial here. I think we have actually several trials in small cell using Avastin in extensive or limited stage small cell. We have the second line trial, which is erlotinib plus or minus Avastin. And we actually have a third line with another related drug. We didn't talk about VEGF-TRAP for cisplatin and erlotinib resistant patients.
What about, though, in non-small cell? You know, you talk to the researchers and they're all using it, again, in these specific patients, and it doesn't seem like it's quite happening in practice. Bill?
I'm using it. One patient now just finished 6 cycles and is on the maintenance of Avastin because I have no idea if that's valuable to the patient. And I'm starting another patient Wednesday if they pass their MRI on Monday, someone I just saw this week.
What about this point of, in a way, it's almost a psychologic thing about the risk of hemorrhage? You know, how do patients respond to that? Bill?
I think they're willing to take the risk if they understand how serious the disease is.
Any predictors of hemorrhage that have been particularly helpful to you, Corey? It looked like the only thing I saw that looked useful was the cavitation.
And that's pretty much it. The numbers are still very small, but Alan Sandler this year at ASCO during the poster discussion presented an analysis of the pulmonary hemorrhage patients, and they really could not come up with anything beyond pre-existing cavitation or the associated development of cavitation that would suggest that those patients be at risk. There was no pre-existing clinical profile that would predict for hemorrhage. Again, central tumors are the only other issue.
I want to ask Dr. Lobo to present his case.
Actually, this case is probably in between. It's not adjuvant, but it's not stage 4. It's an 80-year-old gentleman who actually I saw 2 weeks ago with a non-small cell adenocarcinoma, stage 3B. Plays golf every day, but he has a peripheral neuropathy since he's gone to Cleveland Clinic up in Ohio to see what exactly it is, but they can't find a reason, and it's non-reversible. So he also has a comorbidity of hypertension, The question I have is, what exactly would you offer him? Would you offer him radiation? Would you offer him chemotherapy? Or would you offer him...
He's a wet or dry 3B?
Dry.
Dry 3B.
N3 or T4?
No, it's a T3, but he's got contralateral disease.
So T3, N3.
Yeah.
And how bad is this neuropathy?
It's bad.
Bad. Grade 2 pre-op?
It's a grade 3.
It's grade 2 3?
To 3, yeah.
So he's given up golf?
No, let's say he's grade 2, but he plays golf no matter what, but he takes pain medications throughout. He's taking pain medications every day, which has been prescribed to him.
Corey, how would you think through this?
That's a tough one. So basically, we can't give taxanes. I think you're giving us cogent reasons not to give cisplatin. Again, can still be neuropathic. So, and on the other hand, he's fairly fit, even though he's 80. We have very little data, unfortunately, for the elderly and locally advanced. Up until the early 90s, they didn't seem to do better with combined modality compared to RT alone, but both our retrospective analysis of 9410, which is the big phase 3 study, it's going to be published soon in JCO, looking at concurrent versus sequential, showing a benefit for concurrent, and Steve Schilt's analysis of North Central data, again, looking at concurrent therapies, shows that the elderly will still benefit, particularly if they're fit enough to go on trial. So with all this pre-existing neuropathy, I would probably give this patient carbo at an AUC of 2 weekly during radiation. And you may not be aware of this, but there are phase 1 and phase 2 data looking at arena TCAN with radiation. Hak Choi has done that. I was able to get up to a fairly modest dose, about 30 per meter squared weekly without interruption. We did it with cisplatin. Again, we couldn't get much beyond 40 per meter squared. So knowing all his pre-existing comorbidities, I would tailor a chemo regimen that won't exacerbate his pre-existing neuropathy or minimally exacerbate it. I'd probably give him additional chemo at back depending on how he tolerated concurrent. But the main treatment package is the concurrent therapy.
What kind of chemo at back?
I might continue carbo and arena TCAN or gem carbo.
Vince?
I might have thought about it a little bit differently. I've never been convinced that the body of data for concurrent chemo rads really supports a superiority of carboplatin as opposed to, say, a sequential approach. I might have given this guy induction carbo-gem or induction carbo-pemetrexed and then definitive radiotherapy.
Carbo-pem is actually very good. I'm glad Vince brought that up. University of Chicago has done phase 1 testing of pem alone and then pem-carbo with radiation, showing safety and basically showing that you can get full dose in. One of the big complaints about Taxol carbo in this setting is that you weren't giving systemic doses. So you can pretty much get a carbo dose of 5 in at 3-week intervals, PEM in at 500 per meter squared every 3 weeks. Again, it's a select population. These are folks who were able to get onto phase 1. That might even be better than the initial carbo rena TCAN recommendation. I would still give concurrent. I disagree with Vince. I think the data clearly support concurrent versus sequential.
They do, but with cisplatin. So we get into it's the carbophiles and the sisophiles, but it's the same.
What are you thinking you might want to do?
I actually proposed to him already. I'm going to start him at carbo AUC of 2 with radiation. The reason why I didn't do an induction regimen is because his platelet count's about 120,000. So I figured that, you know, to give him the carbo gem up front would not be a thing. And then if I can, I'd consolidate him with carbo-gem, but I wouldn't know where exactly I would fit.
Be careful with gem in this setting. There is a radiation recall, and
exactly.
I worry about that with PEM as well, but that seems to be less operative with non-gem containing
combos. The problem is none of the studies usually fit these 80-year-olds. And actually on Friday, I saw a 93-year-old lady who was actually driving who probably has lung cancer. So, I mean, she was driving this week and actually presented to the ER because of memory failures. So it's a little different when I present to these patients.
She had brain mets?
Yeah, she did.
What about in the younger, fitter patient, Vince, in terms of options and recommendations in terms of chemo radiation therapy? And what are your thoughts specifically about the 9504 regimen that there's been a lot of discussion about over the last couple of years?
So I think generally if patients have good performance status, you know, no significant weight loss and no comorbidities, we try to give them concomitant cisplatin-based therapy with definitive RT. Even our group and even in individual patients, I'm a little schizophrenic on when I use the posterior docetaxel. The mortality is substantial. It's at least a few percent. You can have some nasty pulmonary deaths. And I generally try not to dose escalate. I'll leave them at 75 per meter squared. I usually do give them a prophylactic Neulastin in that setting. But I tell them there's, you know, probably 50-50 you'll be in the hospital at some point with this. But
even with growth factor?
Yeah, there's other things. You know, the pulmonary infiltrates are a real problem. I've had a patient in the last couple of months die of respiratory failure. And so I do it in a patient whom I want to be aggressive, where a younger patient who's really got through the radiation in pretty good shape, but I do it with trepidation.
The myelosuppression, even with single-agent docetaxel in this setting, is not trivial. I'm a little bit different from Vince. I'll reserve that regimen for super fit patients. Needless to say, the vast majority are not. Remember, SWOG 9504 was a phase 2, not a phase 3 trial. Had a median survival of 26 months. It's the best we've ever seen. It's an outlier, really. When they use that as their platform regimen in the subsequent trial testing gefitinib maintenance, that median survival dropped to 19 months, 19 or 20 months. We have not seen an update. It was not this fabulous 26 months we had seen previously. So knowing that, knowing in RTOG at least, that we typically see median survivals of 16 to 18 months with a taxol carbo, I'll still tend to use it. I'll give it weekly using the Hock Choi approach, and then either out back give docetaxel or continue taxol carbo at full dose using either the Q3 week or the Bolani regimen with weekly paclitaxel at 80 to 100 per meter squared 3 weeks out of four, and then carbo at an AUC of 6. And I find very few of those patients end up in the hospital, at least from myelosuppression.
Scott?
Chris and I actually talked about this case, and what we talked about, and I don't know whether or not this is logical, but you know, my feeling was, in someone who's 80, who has marginal performance status, has other problems, and you want to, A, learn a little bit about the biology of their disease, and B, learn to see how well they're going to tolerate the chemotherapy, my approach has been to start with induction chemotherapy, give them 2 to 4 cycles, and if they respond, are we selecting out those patients that are most likely going to benefit from then the concurrent chemoradiation portion of the treatment, or if they either don't respond or develop metastatic disease or just fall apart with the induction chemotherapy, then you've potentially spared them a modality that they were never really going to benefit from or sort of change the biology or the outcome of their disease.
What regimen do you use?
For the induction chemo? I mean, it depends on the patient. And again, this is sort of, you know, almost class selection.
Let me rephrase that. Do you use cisplatin-based treatment in your 80-year-olds?
Not in 80-year-olds, no.
I agree. I don't either.
And as an aside, I was the pemetrexed fan, but not that many 80-year-olds have a clearance greater than 45, which I think is what's been the package insert.